Dedicating God's temples.
And really, we have several different texts, but the one we're leading up to eventually is Revelation 15:8. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power, and no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. That's Revelation 15:8. Now, building a temple takes an enormous amount of effort, time, and resources. If you've ever witnessed building, even a house, a framed house, which is like nothing compared to a temple, takes a lot of time and effort and resources to build. Just to give you an illustration, Herod's temple was 46 years in building. 46 years in building, just one building. It was a rebuilding of really Solomon's temple. God's temple has been in process of being built for nearly 2,000 years. He's been building a temple that the world is unaware of, and it just dwarfs all these other temples. There's nothing like it. Not that we can point to it. We can't take you to a building site and say, here's God's temple. But you are the temple of the living God, and you are some of the pieces that are going to go into it. So it's a lot of workmanship is going into this temple. Now, temples that men built usually are a tribute to men's skills and their ingenuity. And even when they are dedicated to God, it still represents a lot of man's ability to perform these wonderful things. God's temple is something so monumental. And it's going to be a temple that's being built for His glory, not for a few days, but forever and ever and ever. And so you can imagine the care that God is putting into the building of this building that's going to represent Him forever. Never again will anything be built like it or compare in glory to it. It is once in an eternity that this temple is going to be built, and it will last forever. Now, this reminds me a little bit of one of the Tsars of Russia, who built for himself a beautiful, beautiful palace. It was breathtaking in its beauty and its glory, and when it was all finished, the Tsar, I think it was Peter the Great, he sat in this splendid palace of his, and then he began to worry a little bit, and so he called in his architect, who had done such a fabulous job in building this palace for him. And he put the question to him. He said, now, would it be possible for you to build a temple more glorious or a palace more glorious than the one you have built here? And the architect thought for a while and mused for a while, and he finally came up with the answer. He said, well, I probably could. And whereupon Peter the Great ordered him to be blinded so that he could not build another temple that would or palace that would overshadow the glory of the one that he was residing in. You know, when the wicked bear the rule, the people mourn. And sin is a reproach to any people. And how glad we are that the temple that God is being built is not, doesn't have such ruthless aspects to it. Now, we don't know if God could make another temple more glorious than what He is making now. We doubt it very much. This temple that we're talking about has been the gleam in God's eye from way back in eternity. It was the gleam in God's eye when He created the Logos and the heavenly hosts. And finally, when He created the first human pair, because this was still the dawn of His creative process. he hadn't come to the masterpiece, the building that would be for his ultimate glory. And so finally we come to the new creation. This is the building where God deigns to dwell. And by the way, it's forever. All right, now, you know, when David looked up into the heavens, he saw something of the glory of God. You know, we've all looked up, even as boys, in the country where it was dark. We could really see the stars in those days. There were a lot of them, and there weren't any lights around. And we could see these beautiful display in the heavens. Well, that's what David apparently saw. But now they have this Hubble telescope out there that's looking into the heavens, and it's just like the Queen of Sheba when she came to see Solomon. She says the half was never told. They're finding out that the heavens are so magnificent, and there's such power, such splendor there, that they just stand, you know, we're just like school kids standing on the seashore throwing pebbles into the ocean and trying to ascertain how long it'll take for those radiating waves to go out to the outer limits. Now, the University of California has been studying a newly formed, what they call, bursting star, pulsar. For lack of a better description, that's what they call it, a bursting pulsar. It is believed to be a binary star, that is, there are two parts with it, with one neutron star that has consumed its energy and is believed to be about the size of a Sears Tower, but weighs 10 times the weight of the sun. Now, if you can imagine such compressed material, so heavy, just as big as the building and of the Sears Tower. I'm sure all of you have seen that. And, you know, just to think that this mass can be there. But it died. But there's another star, and it's close to its orbit, which what it is taking energy from and light from, and it's just devouring this star little by little, swatch by swatch. And it's not going gently into the night, but there is a raging against the dying of light. The star locked in with this dying star is being dragged into this dying star, bit by bit, piece by piece, until finally it too will be absorbed into this nothingness, I guess you might call it, a dark hole. Alright, Paul goes on to tell us in Ephesians 2:20-22 that we are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being what? The chief cornerstone. Now you've got an idea of something of this temple. Jesus Christ is the chief cornerstone. What a beautiful chief cornerstone. There's no one like him in all the world. Chiefest of 10,000, as we sing. Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth unto an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together. For what purpose? It doesn't stop there. When this is all built, we are to be what? A habitation of God through the Spirit. I don't think we can conceive of this. God wants to dwell with us. He wants us to be his habitation forever. And of course, Jesus is the chief cornerstone, and all the other stones are to be molded and fashioned after this perfect chief cornerstone. Now, when we look at our nominal church friends' concept of God, some of our good friends in the churches think that God has called them to heaven, mostly as an escape from hell. They praise God that being saved, they will not have to endure the torture and torment of hell, not for a day, for a week, or a month, or forever. And we look at horror at the death camps of Germany, and the mass graves in Bosnia, and in Cambodia, and we shudder. How could people be so mean and so ruthless? Yet our dear friends conjure up thoughts of God presiding over just billions and billions of people who are screaming in agony and pain with no hope of ever being recovered from such suffering. And so this demon theology that has been adopted by Christianity, which really was borrowed from Greek philosophy. There's not a shred of truth in it. Lies, all of it. God would be more like the devil if he had such a purpose in mind as to torture people forever. Now, when Moses wanted to see God's glory, he didn't realize God's glory by his sight. He did see something, and apparently what he saw was glorious, but what he tells us is not what he saw, but what he heard. Now, we can receive what he heard, and that declared God's glory. The Lord God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and mercy and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Exodus 34, 6 and 7. And that's become the refrain of the Bible. It appears, not all of it, but in part, some 66 times in the Old Testament. Yes, God is merciful and gracious. All right, the churches of today do not have a clear concept of God's purpose in calling and selecting his elect. It has been expressed by others that of them sitting on clouds looking out over the ramparts of hell and seeing others tortured, and of course that's so foreign to God's plan. But now when Solomon built the temple, he said in 2 Chronicles 5:18, "But will God in very deed dwell with men on the earth? Behold, heaven, and the heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, how much less this house that I have builded thee." Solomon knew the house that he had built, even with the most extravagant means that he had at his possession, was as nothing in God's eyes. It was most unworthy to receive the God of heaven, or to be the place where God would meet with them. Notwithstanding this, countless edifices have been built for God's glory. How much pleasure has God had in all these temples that men have built? Now, we know that in Jesus' day, the apostles were very impressed with Herod's temple. When they were in the temple, they were standing there, and they were just awestruck, admiring all these different features. Apparently, they didn't get in there as often as some of the others at Jerusalem, because they wandered around the countryside of Israel. But when they were there, they just were being absorbed with the glory of that temple. But Jesus wasn't admiring the temple at all. He was watching this poor little widow throw her 2 mites into the box, and he got excited. He said, "Did you see what she did? She threw in everything she had." And he really was excited about that. And about this temple, he says, "Oh, well, destroy this temple, and 3 days I will build it again." And, of course, that was heresy. That's one of the things they tried to kill him because of that statement. Now, when David besought the Lord, wishing to build God a house, God sent Nathan the prophet, saying, "Thou shalt not build me a house to dwell in. For I have not dwelt in a house since the day that I brought up Israel unto this day, but have gone from tent to tent, and from one tabernacle to another. Wheresoever I have walked with all Israel, spake I a word to any of the judges of Israel, whom I commanded to feed my people, saying, Why have ye not built me a house of cedar?" This is in 1 Chronicles 17:4-6. Never once did God ask to have a house of cedar. Not once. He always went from tent to tent. Why? Well, God dwelt in from tent to tent. It pictured how God would live with his saints as they tabernacled in the flesh, going from place to place, homeless pilgrims journeying toward the heavenly city. This beautifully pictures the gospel age, where God has no house of cedar. All the buildings that they have built have never been God's dwelling place. God is making his own dwelling place, and no man can build this for him. But it's the mighty power of God that is moving to build the house that God is going to dwell in forever. And when the 144,000 is completed, and then of course we will expect the dedication of that temple, which we'll get into. And now the first thing we want to address is the dedication of some of the edifices that had been built and by the direction of God they had been built. And when they were built, they were dedicated. First was the dedication of the tabernacle. I don't know if you realize it, but when it was built, the tabernacle was dedicated. We read in Exodus 4:17, "And it came to pass in the first month in the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was reared up." So if you figure this out, it maybe took about 5 or 6 months to actually build the tabernacle. That's a short space of time to put together all that wonderful material. But if you, how we arrive at this is that Moses was up in the, it took about 3 months for them to leave Egypt to get down to Mount Sinai. And then Moses went up into the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, where he neither ate bread nor drank water. He came down from the mountain, and they were worshiping a molten calf. He threw the stones on the ground, and then we are told that he lay prostrate before the Lord for 40 days and 40 nights, neither eating bread nor drinking water. Then he went up into the mountain again the second time, and he received the tables of stone again with the commandments on them. So there, with all of this space taken up, this would bring us about 5 or 6 months it took them to build the tabernacle. How long did it take to erect it once it was made? Well, it took just one day. And we read that in Exodus 40, verse 17. It was very portable. They could put it together in a day. All right, it was put together. And then in Exodus 40, 34, and 35, we read, "Then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation, because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle." Now, the Israelites were not familiar with with this particular episode. I don't think they'd ever seen God's glory represented in quite this way. And suddenly, this building that had been put together was filled with God's glory. And this meant that God had accepted this as a meeting place with these people. God would meet with them in this tabernacle. It was his choice to do so. And then we read in Numbers 9:15 and 16, "On the day that the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, and at evening it was over the tabernacle like the appearance of fire until morning. It was continually." So it was continually. "The cloud covered it by day and the appearance of fire by night." So there was the glory that filled it, and then thereafter there was the cloud and the pillar of the fire that hovered over this tabernacle. The tabernacle could not be used for any purpose until it was dedicated. And that's what we're going to learn about all of these edifices that God had built. You just can't use this building until the dedication ceremony is complete. All right. Then we come to the next matter of what happened to the tabernacle. It was at Shiloh for some 450 years, and it fell into disrepair. And gradually, because of Baal worship and the sacrilegious tendency of God's people, the tabernacle fell into disrepair. And it was in the time of David that he began to think about this. He wanted to bring the tabernacle up to Jerusalem. And so that was a good idea. And so he made arrangements to bring the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem. And remember how he had built himself a splendid house, a palace, and he was seated in such beautiful, luxurious surroundings. Remember, he was just a shepherd boy when he was young. Now he had risen to the zenith of power, and he was, you know, luxuriating in the most excellent, beautiful palace that probably they'd ever seen in Israel before. And he was a little bit troubled. Here he was in such a house of splendor, and the tabernacle was in ruins, and the Ark of the Covenant was, wasn't in Jerusalem, and he really was quite upset with the contrast. This wasn't right. This wasn't fitting. If anything, the Ark of the Covenant should be in Jerusalem and placed in a beautiful house. But he sought to bring it up the hard way, and he didn't pay much attention to the word of the Lord, and so he put it on a nice newly made cart, and they brought it up to Jerusalem, and of course the cart was wobbling, and you remember how Uzzah reached to steady the ark, and he died before the Lord. And then we read in 1 Chronicles 13, 10 and 11, that he died there before God. And guess what? David was angry because the Lord had broken forth upon Uzzah. Here he was full of good intentions, and God brings this disaster upon him. And he's angry. I don't know why he should be angry. He had no right to be. But he's angry, and it's because the Lord had broken forth upon Uzzah. And then we read in 1 Chronicles 13, 12, David was afraid of God that day. And he said, how can I bring up the ark of God home to me? Now, this is a question he should have asked before he started out to bring it in the first place. You know, now his afterthoughts are much better than his forethought. He learns the proper way to bring up the ark. And so they find out that the ark is in the home of Obed-Edom. And guess what? In the home of Obed-Edom, his household is being blessed. Why? Because the ark is there. God's blessing is just being poured on that house. And the tendency is to think, well, why should Obed-Edom have all the blessings? Why shouldn't it be upon the nation? Let's bring it up to Jerusalem and let it be a blessing for the people of God. Well, you know, it wasn't a blessing when the enemies of Israel had it, when the Philistines had it. It was a plague to them. They were at their wits' end knowing what to do with this ark because they were being plagued to death with it. And so they finally put it on a cart and sent it to the children of Israel. But wherever the ark was in hands that reverenced it, that household was blessed. And that's a principle. Those that reverence me, honor me, I will honor. And then we read in 1 Corinthians 15, 1 and 2, David built houses for himself in the city of David, and he prepared a place for the ark and pitched a tent for it. Then David said, no one but the Levites may carry the ark of God, for the Lord chose them to carry the ark of the Lord to minister to him forever. Now this information was available before, but he comes onto it as a Johnny-come-lately, and now he's reformed, and he's doing it the right way. And so then we come to the matter of building Solomon's temple. David had the ark in Jerusalem, and of course the next thing was for him to build a house for it. And we read in 1 Chronicles 17, 1 and 2, now when David dwelt in his house, David said to Nathan the prophet, behold, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of the covenant of the Lord is under a tent. And so here's Nathan. He says, all right, that sounds good to me. You go ahead and build it, David. Well, again, that was presumptuous on the prophet's part. He was giving advice without having consorted with the Lord. And he no sooner gets out the door, and the Lord turns him right around. He says, you better go right back to David, and you've got to tell him this message in 1 Chronicles 17, 4. You shall not build me a house to dwell in. Those were specific words, and that must have come as a blow to David. Twice he had, you know, full of good intentions for the Lord, and twice he's been rebuffed. Now, you might think that he would say, well, all right, I just give up on this whole thing and be a little bit down in the mouth for a while and forget about it. But no, David, you know, this is a man after God's own heart, and that's what we love about David. He's been beaten down twice, but he rises again. He says, well, if I can't build a house, I'm going to make all the preparations for it. And he does. And not only that, he makes Solomon swear that he's going to build it, and he changes the arrangement because they wouldn't need the Levites to carry articles, so he changes the arrangement of the temple arrangement from the tabernacle arrangement. He provides 24 courses of the priesthood and 24 courses of the Levites to sing in the temple. And so we see that David, if he couldn't do the primary work, had the right spirit. He did what the Lord finally allowed him to do, make all the preparations for it. All right, then we read, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, work on the temple was begun. Solomon began to build in the second day of the second month in the fourth year of his reign, 2 Chronicles 3:2. It took nearly 7.5 years for Solomon to complete this. And knowing that the tabernacle was dedicated before it was used, the time came for it to be dedicated. And oddly enough, we read in reprint 5713, Brother Russell says, it was dedicated about a month before it was completely finished. Doubtless, this contains some important typical lesson which we may someday more fully understand. Now, here he's musing with the fact that it was dedicated before it was really all complete. There were some last-minute things that needed to be done, but they were not of a nature that would have interfered with anything. All right. Then the day came when we read in 2 Chronicles 5:3, wherefore all the men of Israel assembled themselves to the king in the feast, which was in the seventh month, and that's when they brought the ark into the temple. And we read in 2 Chronicles 5:13 and 14, that then the house was filled with a cloud, even the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house of God. You know, at first I think there was a little bit of chagrin. This house was filled with the smoke of God's glory. It was unenterable, and maybe they felt momentarily that maybe something went wrong. Solomon standing there says, that's just what the Lord has promised, that he would dwell in the thick darkness. We read this in 2 Chronicles 6:1. The Lord has said that he would dwell in the thick darkness. All right. Now, Brother Russell, in this article 3283, suggests, and he has a little bit different thought with regard to this glory that fills the temple. He says, that which outwardly had the appearance of a cloud in the sanctuary on the mercy seat represented an extreme brightness so great that the priest could no longer remain in the holy. Whether it was brightness in the most holy or a cloud that was a blinding fog or whether it was really darkness, we're not sure. It's very hard to really find out just what this glory was that filled the temple. I like the thought of light, however, because God is light and in him is no darkness at all and he dwells in unapproachable light. But light can also be blinding to the point that we can't see anything if it gets too bright. We have to shield our eyes. Whatever, we're not sure of that. But what's the meaning in dedicating the temple before it was finished? In reprint 5714, Brother Russell says, and I quote, the fact that the typical temple was filled with the glory of the Lord before it was entirely completed seems to imply that at this present time there will be some manifestation of God's favor toward his church in glorification while yet the work of construction is not quite finished. However, it is difficult to read prophecy in advance of fulfillment. We must wait to see what will be the fulfillment of this feature. But Brother Russell was musing here that there may be some manifestation of God's favor toward the church in glorification while some members are still this side of the veil. And this tied in with his viewpoint of Psalm 149, 7-9, where the saints would be used in executing vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron to execute upon them the judgments written, this honor have all the saints. And this is one of the thoughts that we could tie in with this dedication. Now, there's another event in which the glory of the Lord is used. We all remember the man with the writer's ink horn in Ezekiel 9. And he was told to go throughout the city and to mark everyone that sighed and cried for the abominations that were done. Of course, this was Jerusalem, typical Christendom. And he went through the city, and following him were six men with slaughter weapons, which lieth from toward the north, and every man a slaughter weapon in his hand, and one man among them was clothed with linen, with a writer's inkhorn by his side, and they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. And this is when the man with the writer's inkhorn finishes the work of marking everyone that sighed and cried for the abominations that be done. Then they have a second assignment in the 10th chapter. And we read in Ezekiel 10:2-4, where the second assignment is given to the man with the writer's inkhorn. I know we tend to want to stop the story of the writer's inkhorn with chapter 9. And you know the story that they engage an artist to represent something of the work of Brother Russell, and he drew a picture at Bethel of the man with the writer's inkhorn, and underneath it he put the words, "I have done as thou hast commanded me." And many have applied this at the point of Brother Russell's death. Well, his work wasn't finished when he died. His inkhorn continues to mark. I think I'm one of those who have been marked with his inkhorn, and maybe some of you out there have been marked with his inkhorn since Brother Russell died. His work wasn't finished. The marking on the foreheads wasn't finished when he died. But when that work was finished, he is given a second assignment. And I think that that work isn't finished until the saints are all sealed and they're all fully marked. And then we get the second assignment in Ezekiel 10, verses 2-4. And we read, "And he spake unto the man clothed with linen, and said, Go in between the wheels, even under the cherub, and fill thine hand with coals of fire from between the cherubim, and scatter them over the city. And he went in my sight. Now the cherubim stood on the right side of the house when the man went in, and the cloud filled the inner court. Then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub and stood over the threshold of the house, and the house was filled with a cloud, and the court was full of the brightness of God's glory." Here again, there was a dedication. But when does it occur? This house, apparently it was the temple back there at Jerusalem that Ezekiel was seeing in a vision, was filled with God's glory before the coals of fire were scattered over the city. And so that's a point that we learn in this study. All right, then we come to the Revelation 14:15-17. "Thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time is come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped." Past tense. "And another angel came out from the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar which had power over fire, and cried with a loud voice to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, Thrust in thy sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe." Now here we find the same division. The man with the writer's inkhorn marked everyone. When that was done, and he's given this assignment of scattering coals of fire over the city. There's two separate works. Same thing here. The sickle is cast to the earth to reap the earth of the true wheat. And we read, and the earth was what? Reaped. Then the second assignment is given to go and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth and cast them into the winepress of the wrath of God, where her grapes are fully ripe. All right, the parable of the wheat and tares seems to teach a similar lesson. In Matthew 13:30 it says, "Let both grow together until the harvest, and in the time of harvest I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn." Now, while it is true that many tares have ceased to be tares throughout the world, technically there are many people that profess to be Christians and who no longer profess to be Christians, but still there's more tares now than at any time in human history. 14.9%, or practically 15% of the world, claim to be Christian. That's a high percentage point with the population increasing. Christianity, so-called, has held its own. So there's a lot of professing tares. 15% of 5.5 billion people is a lot more than, you know, like 17 or 18% maybe in Brother Russell's day that was of 2 million people, or 2 billion people. So the population increase has shown with the growth of Christianity that there's more tares now than there ever were. Now, in reprint 5950, Brother Russell observes, and this is one of the few readings that very seldom is referred to by the Lord's people, but he says, and I quote, "The garnering of the wheat continues, but apparently the consuming of the tares will correspond very closely with the division of Jordan. The tares are a class of often noble people who have risen up out of the world infused with hopes and aims of a benevolent character, but misled into thinking that they are the church, the temple of God that we're talking about. From the tare viewpoint, the wheat are an abnormal growth, a peculiar people, few in number, and not held in high esteem. The smiting of the waters will reveal the truth in respect to what is the real church of Christ, and what are imitations. And the honest-minded tare will be undeceived and cease to longer pretend that they are the church of Christ. Thus they will be burned or cease to be as tares, continuing, however, as noble-minded, worldly people, and will share in the general blessings of the sweet by and by under the kingdom." So here Brother Russell is saying that one of the ways, really, that the tares are going to be burned is when they know who the true temple class is. When you're not a part of it, you'll know that you're not a part of that church. All right, then we come to the fourth dedication. That's Ezekiel's temple. Oddly enough, Ezekiel's temple is given in great detail how to build it, and the priesthood and the sacrifices and everything associated with Ezekiel's temple is given to us, but it was never built. The only point that we're going to consider here is that at a certain point this temple existed, at least in vision, to Ezekiel. And we read in Ezekiel 43, verses 2 to 5, "And behold, the glory of God of Israel came from the way of the east, and his voice was like a noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. And it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city, and the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Chebar. And I fell upon my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the house." By what gate? By the east gate. You know, the tabernacle faced which way? East. So the glory of the Lord comes into this Ezekiel's temple, and it comes in by way of the east gate, whose prospect is toward the east. "So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house." Now that's marvelous. The Lord enters in through this east gate, his glory does, and then they go out of that east gate, and then what? We read in Ezekiel 44:2, "Then said the Lord to me, this gate shall be what? Shut. It shall not be opened. No man shall enter in by it, because the Lord, the God of Israel, has entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut." And really, shut forever. That's the closing of the door. When the Lord's glory enters that temple. And then he goes out. His glory fills the house, and the door is shut. But oddly enough, the glory of the Lord fills the temple twice. Because in Ezekiel 44:4, we read, after the glory of the Lord fills that temple, they go out the east gate, and the gate is shut. Then where do they go? They go around to the north gate. And then we read in Ezekiel 44:4, then brought he me the way of the north gate before the house, and I looked, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord, and I fell upon my face. So there seem to be two fillings with glory here, once from the east gate and once from the north gate. Now, what could that mean? Could it be that the door is shut while some saints are on this side of the veil and no one may enter it again? It's sealed in that sense. But when they enter through the north gate, that's when the church is all on the other side of the veil complete. None are on this side of the veil at all. And so here we have two recordings of the glory of the Lord filling the house, one when the Lord enters the east and the other when he enters by way of the north. Now, some have thought the Lord may literally have some rare phenomena in the heavens to mark the filling of the house with God's glory. Even as he had the guiding star guide the wise men from the east and the manifestation to the shepherds when our Lord was born, might there be some phenomena in the heavens that would indicate the church is complete? I don't know. The scriptures don't seem to tell us that there is going to be such a phenomena, but I would not be surprised if that would be true, because God seems to have always had some phenomena associated with these great events. But that we leave to our imagination. All right, then the last one is God's true temple. And the part that we're really interested in is when that is filled with God's glory. We read in Revelation 15:8, and the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his tower, and no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. Here we see the final dedication of the true temple of God, which temple ye are. And at last the moment comes when the temple of the tabernacle of testimony in heaven is opened, Revelation 15:5. The heavens are opened, and the temple of the tabernacle of testimony. Well, that's a funny expression, it's a strange expression is what I mean to say. Now, when the ark was brought into Solomon's temple, there was nothing in it save what? Two tables of the law. It did not have the other witnesses in it. It didn't have Aaron's rod that budded. And it didn't have the pot, a golden pot of manna. And there's nothing said about what was later added, the book of the five books of Moses were apparently put into the ark as well, because we read in Deuteronomy 31:24-26, and it came to pass when Moses had made an end of writing the words of this law in a book, that would be Deuteronomy, that would be the last book, until they were finished, that Moses commanded the Levites which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law and put it in the side of the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, that ye may be there, it may be there for a witness against thee, against the children of Israel. Now, we know that this witness that is in the true temple of God will have the golden pot of manna, because he that overcometh will I give to eat of what? The hidden manna. So it will be there. And that's a witness that anyone that is able to partake of this is worthy to be of this class, this temple class, because they are privileged to eat of this golden pot of manna, this pictured immortal life, which will be theirs. And also, Aaron's rod that budded, some might pretend to challenge the church's right to power. But no, they will not be able to do so because the witness, God's witness, is with those that he has sealed in this temple. And remember in the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and then afterward the leaders complained, and so Moses said, everyone put a rod into an ark, every one of the tribes. And you know what happened. The witness was that Aaron's rod budded. We read in Numbers 7:8, it came to pass that on the morrow Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi was budded and brought forth buds and bloomed and blossomed. And lo and behold, overnight it had yielded almonds. Can you doubt that this was the Lord's doing? So the witness was there. All the witness and power that was invested in the tabernacle arrangement, this testimony was there. And we believe that in the true temple, the witness will be there. Now, the temple will house the tables of God's law, showing that the righteousness of the law is fulfilled in us who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. Nevertheless, the foundation of God standeth sure, having the seal, God knoweth those that are his. All right, then we come unto the biblical climax. What follows is the most important. In Revelation 15, verses 6 through 8, and we read, and the seven angels came out of the temple, having seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, and that is after it's dedicated, with the smoke of God's glory, and having their breasts girded with golden girdles, and one of the four beasts, apparently justice, gave unto the seven angels seven golden bowls, full of the wrath of God, who liveth forever and ever, and the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. And so, when you get to the point where that temple is dedicated and it's filled with God's glory, no one can enter into it, no one can go out, but after it's dedicated, then the seven angels go forth with their seven golden bowls to deliver the wrath of God that is poured out without mixture. And so, therefore, we believe that there must be three conditions met before the plagues can be poured out. First, the bowls have to be divinely supplied. Two, the temple has to be dedicated, being filled with God's glory. Three, no man is able to enter the temple during this time. In other words, the door will be shut. And so we believe those three conditions precede the pouring out of these seven last plagues. What does the dedication of the true temple portend? The purpose of the study is not to get out into the pouring of the plagues, but to deal with the scriptural prerequisites before this can happen. The scriptures are very plain that the seven last plagues are not poured out until after the temple was filled with the smoke of God's glory, after it's dedicated, after the tabernacle of witness is opened in heaven and the witness is seen to confirm the church as being identified with this temple. All right, then we read in Revelation 16:1, and I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, go your way and pour out the vials of the wrath of God upon the earth. Now, they were given the bowls only shortly after the temple was filled with God's glory. Our verse indicates that they are commissioned to pour out their bowls, which had just been provided. In other words, we do not see a long lapse of time between the time they received the bowls, the temple being filled with God's glory, and then they're being poured out. Why is the dedication of God's true temple important? Sometimes we read of these great events with only passive interest, thinking, yes, it is wonderful that God dedicates his tabernacle and his temples before he allowed them to enter into service. However, we see that the Lord has gone through a lot of pages of his word dwelling on these matters with a lot of careful detail to convey certain lessons. The tabernacle was several months in making, but it was put together and dedicated in one day. None of the blessings of that tabernacle arrangement were available to anyone until the dedication was complete. God is not remiss in manifesting His glory when the time comes. When the moment strikes, the temple, God's true temple, will also be dedicated and be filled with His glory. When that happens, then we are certain that that God has finally finished His masterpiece, that He is prepared to enter into His temple, the thing that He had been planning and preparing and indicting for a whole eternity. You must imagine that God has been waiting anxiously for this moment. He has a whole eternity of preparations, 2,000 years of intense power being focused on the development of the church. Do you think He's going to be remiss when that temple is complete for manifesting His glory in it? It'll never happen. He is going to reveal His glory in that church. This is His masterpiece. This is what He has been indicting for eternity. And ye, brethren, are part of that temple. So then we see the tabernacle was dedicated, Solomon's temple was dedicated and filled with the smoke of God's glory, even before it was finished in every sense of the word. It only had one witness, Solomon's temple, and that was the two tables of the law. The tabernacle had the three, and later on a fourth had been added, which was the five books of Moses. Then we get the lesson of the man with the writer's inkhorn, who was commissioned to do two works. First, he went and he went through the city and marked those that sighed and cried for the abominations that be done. And behind him were six men with slaughter weapons. They were doing a faith-destroying work. And we believe that's been going on in the harvest. You have so many forces that are at work destroying faith in the Bible. One of the modern ones is evolution and theosophy, Christian Science, and other features have come in, the New Age movement. All of these things are here doing a faith-destroying work.
...that they have of truth, in which you're...
...doing a faith-destroying work. And so the men with the slaughter weapons are going through Christendom, and they're destroying faith in the ransom sacrifice of Christ. They're destroying faith in the Bible that Brother Rick was telling us about, that the Lord's people have put their trust in. And so this work has been going on. And now when that work is complete, when the work of marking those that sigh and cry is complete, then the next work is what? He's given the assignment in the 10th chapter of Ezekiel to go in between the altar and gather coals of fire from off the altar and do what? Scatter them over the city. But before that happens, the temple is filled with the smoke of God's glory, just as in Revelation, the 15th chapter. Before the seven last plagues are poured out, the temple is filled with the smoke of God's glory. All right, then of course, then we come to God's true temple. It's also filled with glory. And there are seven angels who are given seven golden bowls to pour out the wrath of God. And so this is a part of God's arrangement. When His church is glorified in the sealing of the saints, then He wants to execute the judgments written. Before the plagues could be poured out, they had to wait for the glory of the Lord to fill the temple. And then, from the temple, filled with God's glory, the seven angels proceed to pour out their bowls. And here, in a nutshell, is our review of the lesson of today. You know, they say the devil is in the details, but that's true sometimes, maybe in certain ways. But God is in the details of the Bible. In His Word are secreted so many wonderful truths. And when we take the time to put them all together, we see that the Lord is in these details, and the Lord is especially in the glory that fills his temple.